Adonal Foyle joins us on Sports Byline USA. He's been with me many times before because we always have insightful, interesting discussions about issues in sports. And, of course, he played in the NBA for 13 seasons, 10 of those with the Golden State Warriors. He was a first-round pick, 8th overall, after he played his college ball at Colgate University, where he was an academic All-American. Grew up on a small island in the Caribbean with a population of 1,000. He founded Democracy Matters, a nonprofit political organization that encourages grassroots involvement in the campaign finance reform movement, and he has been inducted into the World Sports Humanitarian Hall of Fame. Adonal, I wanted to let things kind of settle down so we could look over the landscape of what's happening in society, in sports, about racial relations in this country, in the world, and particularly the empowerment of athletes now. It seems like we're seeing something with athletes from the empowerment standpoint we've never seen before. But let me start by asking what your view was of the United States before you even came here from a racial standpoint. And when you first got here, you have told me stories about what it was like. You did not know what racism was when you were down in the Caribbean growing up.
Yeah, and I think one of the biggest thing, you know, someone who grew up in the Caribbean, I've always had all of the instrument of power in my country for the most part. Has been kind of an African American in almost every instance. So when I got here, I've always have a relationship with white people, but they were always at a distance because they were on a yacht. I would talk to them on the beach, but they weren't in the constant, the day to day of my life. So it was very different for me coming to the United States. So when I got to the United States, I used to refer to myself, I was from the Caribbean, so Caribbean American. And, the world saw me as African American. So I thought that it doesn't really quite much matter what you think of yourself. It's almost as the way the society sees you. So I think that's been one of the thing that is very, very subjective, basically, based on where you are, you know, people determine you based on how they see you rather than how you see yourself sometimes. So it's always that battle between how you see yourself and how other people perceive you. And that battle continues, I think, and the American story is the kind of the fight between those two realities.
Your view of the United States from a racial standpoint, how did it change and at what point did it change once you came to the United States?
I had I was playing with the Orlando Magic a game in Orlando when I first I left from Golden State, went to Orlando. I was driving to the airport after a game. We were going to another game. I was speeding, probably going about 5 to 10 miles above the speed limit. I was pulled over. And so I was sitting in the car. The officer came to the car, asked me to come out. And so when I walk out of the car, I went from probably 6 feet to 6'10". And so I was kind of, you know, trying to unravel my body. And I saw the officer and clip his side, his gun on the side and put his hand in it. And I remember just thinking that my life was over. I remember scared to death. And as I see him and as he continued to pull on his gun, the only thing I can say is that my name is Adonal. I play for the Orlando Magic and I'm on my way to the airport. And we have two cops in the plane because that was the way I saw him reacting to me. And so he stopped. He let me go. I drove to the plane and I told the other cops at the plane what happened. And it was one of those defining things where I thought I was doing everything right. I had my hands in the wheel. I went through the same steps that my step-parents had taught me. And yet I saw in this person's eye the way he saw me and how afraid he was of me. And that things could have gone very differently that night. So for me, it was an opportunity to really get to know that it doesn't matter how I saw myself, he saw me as a threat. And that was something that will always live with me for as long as I'm around, and one that helped define who I became in many ways.
I might point out to people, I've known Adonal for many, many years. He grew up on that small island in the Caribbean, as I mentioned, with a population of 1,000. He was brought to the United States by a white couple who were professors at Colgate. What is it that they told you about race in this country, as you alluded to?
So much of what they did was they didn't really tell me what was happening. So one of the things I remember, for example, I would go to a movie, and I had a car, so they would let me go to a movie. And for the longest while, I didn't understand. So when I was, I had a curfew, so I would be coming back home. I had to be home by 10, and they will stay up, and they will wait until I was coming up the driveway, and then they will, like, you know, scatter after bed before I got into the house because they didn't want me to feel like they were watching me. So many, many years ago, I asked them, I said, why did you guys always stay up? Every time I went out, doesn't matter how late I stay out, you guys always stayed up. And I see you running to your room when I'm coming up the hill in the car. I see you turn off the light and go to sleep. Why did you guys do that? And what they were saying was, you know, we knew so much that was out there that we were trying so hard to protect you. So they did a lot of things from talking to, you know, basically watching me without telling me everything that was there. So I learned along the way that they had protected me from so much. But every time, you know, we had talked about our interaction with police officer, how to respond if something happened. So there were many instances where we had a conversation about making sure you put your hand at the wheel, making sure you pull off in a safe area, make sure you pull off in a lighted area, make sure you don't do any have any sudden movements. So there were so much different things that I learned consciously and unconsciously in my interactions with my step-parents.
You mentioned to me when we had a conversation some time ago about coming to the United States, and I think you came to Philadelphia, if I'm not mistaken, went to school there. And you mentioned about the first time you endured or came in contact with racism.
Yeah, there have been so many instances, you know, throughout the course of my life that I had to really reckon with. So much not the way I saw myself, because, you know, I saw myself always as a kid, you know, always happy. I'm outside, I'm walking, I'm around people. My natural predisposition is to be happy. And I think so much over the years is that I have been given this these rules of how to engage. One of the ones that I think stuck with me wasn't in Philadelphia, but I think was later when I went to Hamilton. You know, there's been so many incidents for me and how people saw me. So I was accused of being an Oreo cookie at one point. And then, you know, the reverse part, you know, many of the incidents I had been pulled over. And there were many other incidents of racial kind of animus a little bit. But I've always kind of dealt with most things. We're just kind of shrugging it off and being enlightened to the idea that everybody is the same, nobody is better than me. So I grew up with that ethos. So my natural inclination is to believe that everybody, you know, has a right to live and breed and to be who they are. So I've never really fought the idea that I was different than anybody else. I merely fought the idea that I was less than anybody else. So I think that's been the constant fight that you go through in your life.
In about 90 seconds we have before we have to break here, I'm just wondering, being an athlete, being an outstanding athlete, being an NBA first-round draft choice, did in any way that change people's perception of you as an African-American?
I think what it did was it showed that I was, I guess, different in a way because I had talent to excel. And that's why it was always so important for me to excel, not only athletically, but academically. I think that in many ways that we value our work by something through sports. And I was very, very cognizant of the fact that I had to be more than that, especially where I came from, being the first in my family. So there's always this motivation to be better, to be the best, you know, to work harder. And I think along the way is to really be the best version of yourself. That has always been the fight. It's how could you be better for the people around you and to show an example. But I think that balance between academic and sports has been one that I felt like, we have to excel. It's important to excel in sports, but it's also important to excel in the academic realm as well. So that constant battle has been the one that I fought most of my life.
We're having an interesting and insightful conversation with Adonel Foyle, 13 years in the NBA, 10 of those with the Golden State Warriors after he was a first-round draft pick in the NBA by Golden State. He played his college basketball at Colgate University, where he was an academic All-American, and he has been inducted into the World Sports Humanitarian Hall of Fame. We continue across the country and around the world. We've got you on America's sports talk show, Sports Byline. Adonel Foyle is with us here on Sports Byline USA. He and I are having a very interesting conversation about race in the United States, about race and athletes and empowerment as far as people and also athletics, people in athletics and what they're doing. I want to follow up a little bit on that conversation we had about athletes, African-American athletes, and how they're perceived and viewed. I know there was a period of time, and probably it still exists to some degree, where if you were African-American, nobody probably wanted you to live in their neighborhood. But if you were African-American and an athlete in professional sports or a star in some particular way, that barrier kind of dropped a little bit. I've always tried to understand why that would happen because someone was an athlete or a star athlete. Any thoughts that you might have about the way people who are African-American and are stars in some way, whether it's sports or whether it's in entertainment or anything, why that changes people's perception, Adonel?
So I've always believed that what made sports such a powerful mechanism for change is that it puts different people from across the world, from different background, race, ethnicity, it puts them together and it says, I want you to be the best version of yourself. And I think when you do something like that, it's like you sweat together, you run together, you cry together, you complain together, you want to basically rip the coach's head off when you're doing all the suicide together. So you learn to really trust the soul of each other rather than the skin color of each other. I think that's what the power of sports at its best, is represents that. So I think in many ways is that what we're striving for is for people to understand and to see us for who we are. And I think in sports, you don't have a way to hide. You can't hide from each other. You have to be in each other's space. You are in cramped quarters. And therefore, you have to find the soul of another, of a person, rather than the color. And I think similar, when people move in to a black family or black person move into a neighborhood, there's a lot of trepidation as to whether or not you're going to be accepted. But I think it's just like sports, when you realize that you can go over and have a drink, you can go over and talk to this person, that they're not this unusual person, that they have the same desires and dream as you do. They want the same thing for the kids and the family. And I think once you start realizing and you learn to trust what's beneath the surface, I mean, that's the definition of having a profound conversation with someone, you know, not that the superficial conversation, but the willingness to break the surface. And when you break the surface, you can't help but see the soul of the person. And if you're willing to engage in that walk, if you're willing to take that journey with somebody who's different than you, what you realize is that we all struggle in our own demons. We all have our own concerns. The only truth is what you bring to the table. And I always say, I bring my best version. I bring my best self to the table. And I hope you bring your best self as well. And when we engage, I hope you get to see me and pierce beyond the brown skin or the black skin that I have and look deeper to the soul of the person. When you do that, I think we tend to find each other and realize that the fear that we have, the pre-existing fear, it's come from someplace else. It's not real. And in many instances, you can find each other through conversation and through living in the same area. I think people realize that we're not so different once you spend time and get to know a person rather than get to know the class.
You know, you bring up a very good point about the fear, and I've never been able to understand where that fear comes from and why. And now I know it's partially historical because of the history of this country and what has happened before, but I can't see where someone can look at someone and say, I'm going to hate this person, I'm not going to like them, I'm going to do something to them just because of the color of their skin. Now, I happen to be white, And I guess maybe that's part of the reason why I can't understand it, because that's not the way it has been. And I've had so many people of different persuasions and different ethnicities that I can't relate to at all. Maybe you can give me some insight as to why you think that fear exists.
Well, I think the fear in many ways have been a learned response, right? So, I mean, mm-hmm. I always laugh because, you know, when you see a young kid and they have no consciousness of race, they go, they're happy, they play with each other, and they put another black kid, a white kid, it doesn't really matter. Kids, by its nature, I think they're pure. And I always say is that we as adults, we mess with the heads of our kids because we put stuff into their head consciously and or unconsciously about fears that exist. That in many ways it's like there wasn't any way for them to kind of debunk that because they weren't around African Americans, they weren't living in the same area, they weren't going to the same school. So I think that part of the fear that has developed over many years is, well, this is what happens there. This is what happened here. We have general ways of referring to people and their experiences. And I think in many ways is that we have learned this fear of how to hate each other and to look for somebody else in many instances to define our reality, right? So we are also ahead because somebody else is not. So we've always defined ourselves by where we are in our success. And therefore, we defined our reality based on that. So you have a group of people that, you know, if you try very hard not to connect with them, then you will see them as something other. So I think that part of what you've seen is a history, hundreds and hundreds of years of really learned hate. And if you're not aware of it, if you're not willing to unshackle yourself from it, if you're not willing to do the work that it takes to get to know the soul of somebody else, then that will be one of the blind spots you have, right? Because you have to be willing to face that reality that none of us are different. And that reality requires a kind of engagement with the other people of other different races to see that what we are is all trying to struggle for the same truth. And what we are is this fear that we have been living with, and we have been told to fear a group of people. And that, whether or not it's conscious, sometimes it lingers underneath the surface. And when a reality comes up or when a situation comes up, you remember that fear that you have in order to elicit a current response. So I think it's just the battle that we all struggle with as human beings. You know, we all, you know, have our preconceived notion about other groups, and we have to contend with those reality. Otherwise, I think that's when the slippage happens, and that's when we start seeing people as less than rather than equal to.
Yeah, I also think the lack of education, and I think Steve Kerr, the Warriors coach, made a great suggestion saying that our history books are going to have to reflect more the truth of what life has been like for all peoples in this country. In other words, if you take a look at some of the history about the relationship with African Americans in this country, we know about the internment of Japanese in this country, but unless it's presented in its fullness, then people will not realize that there have been some things that have been going on, because I think people only have a partial history of the relationship and about people of different color and different ethnicities. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think one of the most difficult things for us to understand is we have to be willing to walk in the shoes of somebody else. At least we have to be willing to step into it and take a view. I think so much about who we are is about not willing to take that step to really get to know people. So I think that part of the journey for any of us is to really say, okay, I know my experiences is different. Like, I will tell you that my experiences in the Caribbean is much different than your experiences in the United States. So we have to acknowledge that we all bring different things to the table. I think sometimes what we do is that we put a value, and whether or not what you have is valuable, whether or not what you have is valuable. And I think that that's when you start looking for reason to separate people. I think if you just say, okay, I know how I grew up, I know what the challenges was for me, it doesn't mean that I didn't have any challenges in my life, but maybe I don't really understand it from this person's perspective. So I think that willingness to shift ourselves and say, you know what, let me just take a step in and listen. Let me empathize. If we start there, I think what we'll find is that we all have more in common, right? But we forget it because we focus on the things that that are different about us rather than the things that are similar, that rather than the things we celebrate. If we start talking to each other, we realize we can laugh together, we can have fun, we can like traveling. There's so many things we can do together if we will trust the soul of people, if we will take that step to really understand where they're coming from. And unfortunately, we sometimes don't take the time to do that.
In about 30 seconds, what about the economic disparity between races? How much is that a factor, do you think?
I think that's one of the biggest factors. So we could acknowledge, and we all acknowledge now, that a school in Marin and a school in another part of the Bay Area, they're not going to be the same, right? That there is disparities in education, and we're not giving our young people the quality of education across the country and across the board, counties, cities. We don't have the same standard of education. And what has historically happened, we have a group of people who have less access to that education. And we know that one of the great kind of opportunity for people to move up from generation to generation is through education.
Donald Foyle with us. We'll continue this interesting conversation as we move along on Sports Byline. Donald Foyle is with us here on Sports Byline USA. We're talking about the state of race relations, particularly from an athletic standpoint. Donald, I'm just wondering, what is going to be different this time after what happened up in Minneapolis and what's happened in other places, and just historically what has happened between police and also African-Americans, Hispanic-Americans as well? What do you think makes this different, and will it be something that will realize changes in any way in our relations with other people?
I think that one of the most encouraging things I've seen since the 60s is the combination of people of multiple races really engaging in this truth. I mean, I cannot really oversell how important that is, because we know how pivotal it was, not only when it was fighting for the freedom in the South, we also know the impact when white folks came down and really start putting themselves on the line, you know, for change. And you see that here. We have a complex group of people out in the street fighting for what they now see as a reality for African Americans, where you can't hide. There's been tapes. These tapes have revealed anger that has been underneath the surface for hundreds and hundreds of years. And what you're seeing is that people are finally of all stripes are understanding that truth, and they're coming out and showing support. So I think that the sky is really the limit. I think we have an opportunity to really have meaningful conversation about change and meaningful conversation about how we move forward. But I think it all starts with really tying activism to really civic engagement. The job would not be done if we don't really follow up with going to the polls and voting. I think when you see the meager turnout of voters in this country, and you see kind of the impediments put in place for people not to be able to vote easily, I think that's gonna, to me, the next turn. The next turn will be, how do we show up and how do we tie this activism with political outcomes? That, to me, is the next step, and I'm hoping that that's where we're at, because I think we need to follow this amazing show of force in the street in terms of how we present ourselves as a united front. We need to make sure that united front remains when we go to the polling stations this November.
You know, it's very interesting watching what athletes who have a very large, loud portfolio and also have a platform in order to express their feelings about things like this. And we're seeing athletes becoming more involved. And down at the University of Texas, groups, about a dozen Longhorn athletes say they want the school to ditch the Eyes of Texas song and rename several campus buildings. The athletes said that the school should stop using the Eyes of Texas, which has long been criticized for its connection to minstrel shows with characters in blackface in the early 1900s. And I see athletes, Mayfield Brown is one of them, the Cleveland Browns quarterback, who says he is going to kneel in games, and I think there's going to be a loud sign of that happening in sports as well. How successful will that be, and is it going to be more important that it is continuous and that there is follow-up to it for it to have some type of influence or success?
Well, I think that this is a learning opportunity. I remember, like, I go and I work with young people all the time, and it's amazing how many of them have never really organized. We don't teach in school how to organize a protest movement because, in many respects, a lot of people don't have to. But, I mean, I think that part of one of the lessons is, like, how do we engage the world? And that's the challenge for every athlete, right, is that we don't all have to do something, but we can choose to be not racist. We can choose to be anti-racist, or we can choose to live in our blind spots, right? So we have a choice, and I think that what athletes are trying to do is say, look, we've always been people's pause to look at us, to watch us. What are we standing for? Do we want to stand for something more than just being an athlete? Well, there's nothing wrong with that. But I think what athletes have seen is that it doesn't matter how much you see me on this stage, when I walk out into the community, I'm being viewed differently. And that is a disconnect that, you know, we want people to understand, is that, yes, you know, we've experienced amazing progress, but we still have this thing where people don't see us as we are, and that's the struggle. So I think sports has really the ability to really transform the landscape in a sense to really make it possible for that engagement. So I mean, you can't really dismiss the idea that if you're an athlete and you're part of this big team, that success depends on you working together. It doesn't matter who you are. You all have to work together for the outcome of the team. If you start taking those truths and really turning it into society, which is, if we all work together, we could make it better. We don't have to move the mountain by ourselves, but if we really engage each other, we will find the humanity in each other. If we find the humanity in each other, then we'll try to create a more just world for each other. And we all have to kind of lay our shoulder into that truth. I mean, it's easy to say, I agree, but are you willing to lay your shoulder? And that's what you see people are doing in the street now, is they're engaging, they're supporting, but they're being they're really walking that walk with each other. And I think in doing so, they will find that they have more in common than the things that separates them.
Certainly in the past, the power when it comes to sports came from ownership, came from the leagues, all controlled by white men primarily. And I remember back to in 2016 when Colin Kaepernick took the knee, and all the response, the vitriol and everything, what the commissioner said, what the president said, and all of those things. Now, some 4 years later, all of a sudden, the commissioner of the NFL comes out and says, we wrong, we got it wrong, and everything else. And you just wonder if this is a true belief that, hey, we should not have done, we didn't do the right thing at that particular time. And I'm just wondering whether this is something to quiet the people that are, you know, were right in the first place. How do you see that incident? And what is the difference today? Is it something that will be perpetuated as far as the changes that people are asking for?
I think we got to have to wait and see. But I feel like the one truth, sometimes people come to decisions because of, obviously, financial reasons. They come to it because they don't want to be seen as the other. They come to it because they actually truly believe that people are equal. Whatever the reasons that people come to the table, I always say, pull a chair out and allow them to engage. Because I think once you engage, once you have that conversation, I think you will start seeing, maybe we don't agree on anything, but I could agree that the man exists and the man has a right to exist and I have a right to exist. I think once we start having those really difficult conversations, we really do get to see each other. And I think in many ways, that's why I think sports have this ability to really push us. So what Colin Kaepernick did, he says, okay, I'm kneeling for something bigger. We says, we don't want you to do that because you're tainting our sports. And he's like, this is the life I think that everybody's living that needs to be aware of. We say, we don't really want to see it. So I think as sports has this ability to really move the needle really quickly. And if you look at the history of sports from all the different people that participate and have been able to create social change through sports, you could see that powerful dynamic. What we have to do as a society is that we have to listen a lot more and empathize a lot more. So, and I was one of them. I didn't give Colin Kaepernick his true moment, right? We dismiss it as almost bothersome, right? And he was saying, this is one way that we can really engage the world, really push them to want more, to see more, to experience more, to tell them about more, and we push him away. And within the arc, now we are exposed to maybe the truth that he's been seeing, and now we're forced to grapple with it. And what we're doing now, we're saying, okay, I get you, I see you, I hear you. But that conversation, again, started in sports, and that's the power of sports. It has a visceral reaction with people, both negative and positive, but I think in that interaction is the opportunity to grow. We have that opportunity to really feel each other, because I think if you engage, no matter how raw you engage with each other, what you will find is that we all want the same thing, to be happy, to really have a really amazing life for our family and the people around us. We want the same thing. How we go about getting them is different, and how we're viewing society while we get that, while we find our place, is also different for all of us. And that's the kind of things we have to grapple with. If we could do that, then we will see we don't always have to do the extreme thing like we're doing now. Maybe the kneeling would be an opportunity next time for us to have the conversation, rather than to wait until the emotions of people boil over, as we see in the last several weeks.
Yeah, the divide that I'm concerned about is that when Colin Kaepernick took the knee, those that were against him said that it was a demonstration against the flag and against American troops, and that was not it at all. And so do they have a new awareness about what this was all about now that they've seen what's happened in the last 4 years that have been brought to the forefront? And I just don't know whether they will actually get it long term.
And I think that's the hope part in me. I mean, I think the hope part is, I hope you see, I hope you remember, I hope you we're all able to say, look, we may not have liked the way he did it. We may have wanted more conversation. We may have wanted, you know, more experienced leader around him. But we have to give each person in a society the opportunity to engage the world how they see fit. I'm harking back to the idea that I tell the kids all the time. Well, I have, in my Democracy Matters chapter, we have kids from all over the country. And the first thing I say to them is that I don't want you to do what I want to do. I want you to tell me how far you're willing to go. We have to give people the opportunity to find who they are and to find how they want to engage the world. And we can't assume that for everybody they should engage it the way we want them to engage it. We have to allow a plethora of opportunities for people to experience the world and engage the world the way they want. It is our chance. It's our responsibility to listen to it and to say, does that make sense? Is that something I could agree? Do I understand where they're coming from? Can I push them to get more answers? So you can engage. There's a difference between engagement and consent. And I think that's something we get confused. We think that if we condone something, that in some way we are agreeing with everything. And I'm like, sometimes you have to listen and empathize before you can understand. And then when you understand, then there is hope, because you don't have to agree with everything and every position a person have. You have to understand they have a right to live. And if you could at least agree with that, then there is hope for us. Now, as to whether or not this is that moment when we all understand that we are all in this together and that we have to really tackle this mountain together, I think that this might be that time. I think that sports, again, might be leading us in a conversation, in a meaningful conversation that hopefully will bring understanding among people. And understanding takes a long time. Change takes a long time. And we will continue to deal with the change that we have. We're going to have reevaluation of those things in years to come. But if the conversation continues, I'm hopeful that we can see the truth in each other and we can see the pain that that each of us experience. And hopefully we can find resolutions to our problems in conversation and discussion by looking each other in the eye and saying, I see you, I hear you, and hopefully we can change that way.
We have about 45, 50 seconds left, and Democracy Matters, which is a nonprofit political organization that you established, tell people how they can, you know, look into that, because it's a wonderful organization, but we only have about 45 seconds left.
Yeah, Democracy Matters really is about how do you engage the universe. I really see the universe, people see between race and different identities. I also see it in a way of power and money. There's just too much money in the system, and the people who is controlling those systems are not necessarily looking out for the best interests of the community at large. And we, our job is to push back and to really eliminate private money from politics, where politicians are beholden to the constituencies rather than to the people who give them money.
Adano, I want to thank you. Every conversation we've ever had since I met you has been insightful, enlightening, and I appreciate it. I appreciate your friendship, but the way you look at things, and I think conversations like this are important if we're going to move beyond the problems that we do have in life, no matter what they are. Thank you, my friend.
Thank you.
Adano Foyle, again, 13 seasons in the NBA, 10 of those with the Golden State Warriors, and then 3 with the Orlando Magic. And he was the Warriors' first-round pick, the 8th overall pick. And he came from a very small island in the Caribbean with a population of 1,000. He was raised by his grandmother and great aunt, who gardened for a living. And, of course, went to Colgate, became an academic All-American before being drafted by the NBA. I hope you found this instructive and also enlightening. We continue on Sports Byline.